Picture a hospital in Corfu where patients die without family present because there aren't enough nurses after 5 p.m. Now imagine cleaning your alcoholic father's blood-soaked sheets using linens scavenged from empty beds, watching nurses handle transfusions without gloves. This isn't a nightmare. This is Emily Pine's reality, captured in essays that arrived during Ireland's abortion referendum like a cultural thunderclap. What started as private notes hidden in the drawer became a phenomenon that made Lena Dunham declare Pine so sharp she drew blood and prompted Anne Enright to warn readers not to open it in public because it will make you cry. Through unflinching examinations of alcoholism, infertility, sexual violence, and burnout, these essays articulate what many have felt but few have dared to name, creating what became an unexpected lifeline for readers drowning in their own unspoken experiences. When your father vomits blood from his alcohol-ravaged esophagus and you hesitate before helping him, you discover the brutal arithmetic of addiction. Love minus trust equals exhaustion. In that understaffed Greek hospital, the equation became starker. No doctors after 2 p.m., one nurse per ward after 5 p.m., and two daughters responsible for keeping their father alive. This wasn't tender caregiving from movies. This was scavenging clean sheets and watching 12 liters of fluid drain from a grotesquely distended abdomen. The relationship had always been complicated. Dad taught the alphabet backward as a party trick, abandoned his daughters in pubs when angry, and eventually moved to a Greek island deliberately difficult to reach. A year later, he misremembered everything, claiming he'd never been in pain when he'd roared in agony. 4 years later, when Dad published an article declaring, "I am an alcoholic," the response was complicated: pride at his honesty, anger that he never acknowledged the damage to his family. They maintain a fragile peace now. Sometimes when he calls, there's impatience, other times just gratitude to hear his voice. And every single time, her heart races. Because loving an addict means living in perpetual anticipation of the next crisis, the next moment when you'll have to choose between compassion and self-preservation. Watching a friend's child seek comfort crystallized the decision. Yes, she wanted children. The process became clinical, monitoring cervical mucus, scheduling intimacy around ovulation kits, reducing desire to data points. After over a year, pregnancy arrived with joy. Then came the bleeding. Multiple scans revealed no heartbeat, but Ireland's constitutional restrictions meant midwives couldn't confirm the miscarriage, a cruel limbo. A private English midwife carefully implied what she legally couldn't state. At 10 weeks, a fetus without a heartbeat won't develop one. Desperate, she tried acupuncture and massive spirulina doses. The acupuncturist implied she was unbalanced, too much yang, insufficient yin. In sleepless nights, she realized they were trying to cure her of being herself. The pain compounded when her sister announced a pregnancy. The reaction was ugly, feeling cheated, resentful. Then December 30th brought the hospital call. Her niece's heart had stopped. On New Year's Day, Elena Jane was born still and perfect. At the funeral, her sister's straight shoulders were the most heroic thing she'd ever witnessed. Discovering her depleted egg reserve prompted a crucial conversation revealing her partner's unhappiness with the process. They decided to stop, abandoning fertility schedules and planned IVF. The relief was immediate: better sleep, fewer fights, reconnection. Though grief surfaces sometimes, she chose happiness over the monthly cycle of trying and failing. At 5, she cheered her parents' separation. No more fighting. She didn't realize she was celebrating the start of a different war. Silence. Without legal divorce in Ireland, her family existed in limbo. No protections, no child maintenance, her mother supporting them alone while Dad drank away his money. She became the go-between, arranging visits and delivering letters. At 10, she received his suicide threat by phone. At 18, she voted to legalize divorce in Ireland. It passed by just 9,114 votes. Her parents had been separated 15 years. That spring, a travel agent's sign moved her to tears. Package holiday deal, one parent plus two kids. Her family finally existed publicly. In her mid-20s, Dad asked her to request a divorce from Mom. Mom joked about still hoping for reconciliation. Though she told Dad it would be granted, nothing happened. His engagement ended, he moved to Greece, the divorce forgotten. They remain married. After 30 years, her parents finally spoke in January 2013, brought together by her sister's baby's death. They discussed his liver failure, a friend's death, even a previously unmentioned miscarriage. Now they meet for coffee regularly. She's surprised by her anger, confused, relieved, resentful that decades of silence could simply end without anyone apologizing to the daughters who lived in the wreckage. The male-centric metaphor of bleeding onto the page for good writing contrasts sharply with actual menstrual blood that society demands be hidden. Her first period during geography class meant mortification. Blood on her dress, wadding toilet paper in the girls' toilets, later shoplifting tampons rather than discussing it with her mother. The term feminine hygiene frames menstrual blood as dirty. Advertisements use blue liquid instead of actual blood, making women's bodily reality taboo. The feminist slogan that a woman can do anything a man can do while bleeding makes her laugh. But what if she can't? Blood becomes most taboo during sex. Partners have screamed upon seeing it or rushed to wash sheets immediately. As months of trying to conceive stretched into years, her period became a curse marking infertility. She couldn't even say, "I'm bleeding," to her boyfriend. Now approaching menopause in her late 30s, the gradual shift signals childbearing years ending, a greater loss because there was no actual childbearing, only miscarriage. If getting her period meant becoming a woman, its end feels like womanhood's end itself. Getting truly naked means reversing the dialogue that her body is a source of grief. If her body could tell its own story, it would speak of blood's flow and ebb, of touch and pleasure, of illness and recovery, strong, loud, and proud. "I'm not here." This is what she's thinking during an unwanted encounter. She's only 16, and she shouldn't be in this situation. Not on a school night, not in a stranger space. After her parents separated, she discovered the power of restricting food at age 10. Refusing meals gave her control, clean, light, powerful. By 13, thinness remained her most valued attribute. She discovered that male attention could replicate that same sense of triumph, craving genuine affection but accepting physical attention instead, afraid of being labeled negatively. At 14 in London, she became the audacious girl in lipstick and short skirts, misrepresenting her age to access adult venues. She socialized with music promoters, consumed alcohol, attempted to maintain certain boundaries, yet dangerous situations followed: aggressive men, physical injuries, predatory behavior from those in positions of trust. During encounters with strangers, she mentally repeated, "I am not here," creating psychological distance between her consciousness and physical experience. She believed she was making strategic choices, but was actually internalizing the belief that she had no inherent worth. At 14, a man harassed her on public transportation while she was visibly distressed. No adults intervened. Only at 39 did she recognize two experiences as assault. One involving a boyfriend who forced himself on her despite her resistance, another involving an older man who physically restrained her. When she asked why, he claimed, "It's just something about you, a vibe you give off," a damaging explanation she internalized for decades before realizing the so-called vibe was simply being young, vulnerable, and female. Only in her 30s did she fully embrace physical autonomy and genuine connection, finally able to say, "I am very much here." What began as private notes hidden in a drawer evolved when her partner discovered them and encouraged sharing. She began writing about experiences never shared before, painful to excavate but necessary to reclaim denied parts of herself. These raw essays resonated deeply, with readers responding with their own stories, creating unexpected dialogue about shared human experiences. These essays tackle subjects shrouded in silence: alcoholism, infertility, sexual violence, family dysfunction, menstruation, professional burnout. Writing about her father's alcoholism illuminates the exhausting dance between enabling and tough love, constant anxiety, and cycles of hope and disappointment. Detailing her miscarriage and fertility struggles challenges cultural taboos, from the clinical sterility of IVF clinics to the profound loneliness of pregnancy loss. Throughout, silence perpetuates suffering. The 30-year silence between her parents shaped their children's understanding of relationships. Silence around menstruation creates shame about natural bodily functions. Silence prevented her from recognizing sexual assault for what it was. What's ultimately offered is a masterclass in how writing becomes reclamation, transforming private pain into public voice, isolation into connection, and moments of shame into sources of strength.